Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Our speaker is Sherry Berman, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Professor Berman's lectures titled Populism and the Future of Liberal Democracy in the West. We begin with an introduction by Center for the Study of Europe director Kathy Jo Martin.
Well, I am really thrilled today to get to introduce Sherry Berman. And Sherry comes from us from Barnard College at Columbia University. Sherry's someone that I have known and admired for many years now, so I'm really excited we could persuade her to kick off our term in which we look at the rise of right-oriented populism in Europe. So Sherry is going to talk about populism and the future of liberal democracy in the West. And her research interests include European history and politics, the development of democracy, populism, and fascism, and the history of the left. And she's written a number of really wonderful articles and books for both scholarly and non-scholarly publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, and Vox. She's on the board of the Journal of Democracy, Dissent, and Political Science Quarterly, and her most recent book, Democracy and Dictatorship, From the Ancien Regime to the Present Day, is forthcoming from Oxford University Press. So I'm not going to speak more about Sherry's accolades, as many as there are. It would take us all day, but I think I'll just turn it over to you. So thank you so much again for coming.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you, by the way, for joining us. Yep. Really happy to see everybody.
Well, thank you, Kathy, and thanks to all of you for hosting me here. So I'm going to talk about this incredibly optimistic topic today, populism and the future of democracy in Europe, and hopefully you won't all be crying by the end of the conversation. So for anybody who reads the newspaper, which I assume since you're all here, all of you do, you know that there's lots of talk today about democracy being in crisis, right? So there are a whole variety of organizations out there whose job it is to kind of analyze what's going on with democracy, to kind of tell us, you know, what the trends in the world are. And if you'd been looking at any of these reports or reading the newspaper media coverage of them, again, you would get this idea that democracy was in crisis, right? So Larry Diamond, who's probably one of the foremost experts of the state of democracy in the world today, has written the world is in the midst of a democratic recession. Freedom House, again, one of these organizations whose job it is to chart what's going on with different kinds of political regimes in the world, entitled its 2018 report, cover of which is right here, obviously, quite, you know, sort of evocative, Democracy in Crisis. The Economist Intelligence Unit's similar report, 2017 Democracy Index Report, is entitled Democracy Continues Its Disturbing Retreat. Now, in fact, despite the kind of apocalyptic visions that, you know, you sort of would hear from both the media and actually the sort of more sophisticated analyses, in fact, it's not true that democracy is in crisis everywhere. In fact, democracy is still, as you can see from this lovely chart, which is actually made from another great organization that studies democracy called the Varieties of Democracy Project. If you take a look at the blue line, okay, you can see actually that we are today, right, still at an unprecedentedly high level of number of democracies. Okay, and actually this index, Liberal Democracy Index, this is a much more stringent index than just democracy, right? Democracy is essentially free and fair elections. The Liberal Democracy Index includes a whole variety of other things, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, rule of law, blah, blah, blah. So if you look, right, if we were to start at the interwar period, right, which is obviously not a good time for democracy, you can see actually that we are still in a relatively good position. Right? So when people talk about democracy in crisis, it's not the case that we have fewer democracies today than in the past. In fact, just on a quantitative measure, we actually have more democracies today pretty much than at any time in the past. So what's the crisis? Well, there are some very disturbing trends. For the first time in 2017, we had the same number of countries backsliding as going forward since what we think of as the third wave of democracy, which began essentially in the 70s and 80s. That is to say, there were as many countries whose democracy scores were going down as were going up. So that means that, again, we are in a slightly different position than we would have been in any years since the last quarter of the 20th century. In addition, a number of very large countries have been backsliding. That is to say, the quality of their governments has gone down, democratic governments has gone down over the past years, countries that you probably are familiar with, India, Brazil, places like that. So there's lots of people in those countries. So the fact that the quality of their democracy is declining makes a big difference. But the real thing that is unusual, historically, is the two lines that are at the top, right, which is the European Union and the United States. Why is that unusual? Well, as you can see, over the last couple of years, the quality of democracy in those places has gone down. Now, this is unusual and worrying because these were places, the European Union and the United States, where we kind of thought democracy was no longer in play, right? These were considered, in the political science jargon, consolidated. These were countries where we thought democracy had come to stay, and so we wouldn't have to be concerned about them backsliding. That is to say, the quality of democracy decaying. So this, actually, it's the top two, the red and the green, the European Union and the United States, where the crisis actually is. Because again, from the perspective of the world overall, we're not talking about an actual decline in the number of democracies. In fact, we are at a historic high. So this is the puzzle that I want to talk a little bit about today, and in particular, since I'm at a European center, I'm going to be talking about the European case. But what I'm saying today actually, I think, holds true essentially for the United States as well. So the question is why, right? What is the cause of this decline in the quality of democracy, and in particular for the rise of populism? And these two things are intimately related, not only because I'm going to talk to you about some of the common causes of the two, but because much of this decline in the quality of democracy, the way it's measured, has to do with the rise of populism and the thing that populist politicians and parties represent. So let me talk to you a little bit about that today. So the most common explanation for the rise of populism, in particular, and the one that I think you still probably most often hear in the media, focuses on economic factors as underlying the rise in support for populist parties and politicians, right? So this is a very well-known graph that was done originally by an economist, Branko Milošević, and it's called the elephant graph. Maybe if you look at it, you can see why, right? It's kind of like an elephant's trunk, yeah? And why is this graph so evocative, right? Well, as you can see, what the graph is kind of showing here is that globalization, or let's say global economic development over the past generation or so, has really favored two kinds of people or two kinds of places, right? One is, actually, there's been incredible economic development in what we consider to be the developing world. Incredible declines in poverty, huge rise in the number of middle-class folks in the developing world, particularly, obviously, China, and to a lesser degree, but also really critically important, India. So global economic trends have really benefited developing countries. They've captured a huge amount of the gains over the past generation. In the advanced industrial world, again, the United States and Europe, the gains over the past generation have gone to the very top. Right? So within the advanced industrial world, the already developed world, those gains have gone to a very small number of people. Now, why has this helped to explain populism? Well, because it helps to explain, again, divisions within advanced industrial societies. The vast majority of people have not benefited from economic development over the past generation. So that helps to explain, in a lot of people's minds, why we've seen these conflicts and dissatisfaction. And it also explains, for a lot of people, why a lot of people in the developing world are pissed off at people in the developed world, or pissed off at globalization, right? So the arguments generally follow this kind of logic, right? So who are the people supporting populist parties? Who are the people dissatisfied with democracy? Well, they're the losers of globalization, right? In the United States and in Europe, right, those would be the people who, again, following this logic, would be the supporters, right? And who are these people? People with low education, working class folks, blue collar folks, especially where unemployment is high. People who are at growing risk from economic and technological change. People who are dealing with declining social mobility, right? Rising economic inequality. Again, these are the kinds of people you would expect following this logic to vote for populist parties. People who live in areas that have suffered particularly heavily from economic change, right? We saw a lot of discussion of this in the recent election, right, where you saw, in particular, consequential swings for Trump in regions that were seen as, again, not part of the sort of vibrant center of the American economy, similar kinds of dynamics in Europe. Again, areas where, again, you have high concentrations of people who feel like the global economy is passing them by. Now, if you look at the evidence for these kinds of economic explanations, it's not particularly strong. So there's very limited evidence that connects people's direct personal economic situation to voting for populist parties, right? So there's not a lot of good evidence there. There's somewhat better evidence linking people's assessments of their country's economic state overall to voting for populism. So people who may themselves be doing okay, but feel like their country is going to hell in a handbasket, or who feel like the future is grim, even though they themselves are doing well, those people do have a greater tendency to vote for populist parties. But the direct economic link, there's not a lot of good evidence for. Okay, so what's some other explanations? Well, the other explanation, again, very popular in the media and also among academics to explain the rise of populism, again, Europe and the United States, has to do with social trends or demographic trends, right? And here the focus is on, in the United States and in Europe, again, on changing demographics. So this ends, this is the United States Census Bureau. Actually, the new census data recently came out. That trend goes up even higher. We're now at 13.7% foreign-born in the U.S. Again, we haven't had that high a level of foreign-born residents in the U.S. since the beginning of the 20th century, when, again, for those of you who know something about your American history, there was also a kind of populist or nativist, I would say, backlash, right? So huge changes in our demographics. The change is even more dramatic in Europe. Why? Because, first of all, many European countries don't have a tradition of immigration like the U.S. has, right? So they're dealing with trends that there's actually no, again, history or experience dealing with. And there are now several countries in Europe, including one that I spend a lot of time thinking about, Sweden, where the percentage foreign-born is actually much higher than in the U.S. And again, if you had spent some time in these countries a generation ago, these were extraordinarily homogenous countries. So this is an incredible demographic shift, actually, that has been going on in Europe and the United States over the past generation, right? So the arguments here are pretty sort of straightforward, right? The argument here is that what we're seeing with populism is essentially a nativist backlash, right? People are pissed off about the changing demographics, particularly white people, right, who would have been the dominant group forever, and now all of a sudden are seeing these changing demographics, and they're concerned about, again, the way, whether or not their dominant position in society will continue in the future, right? And this is, of course, layered on top of dramatic cultural shifts that started in the 1960s, right, which sort of eroded traditional mores and traditional values, leaving lots of people kind of very concerned about their societies, right? People who feel sort of, again, like the world is changing in ways that make them uncomfortable and where they're concerned that they're no longer going to be, you know, sort of in charge of the way things are going. Okay, I don't want to spend too much time on these things, but again, just to give you a brief sense of what folks are thinking. Again, another type of explanation would combine these two, right? Say, okay, look, there's economic trends that have been going on, there's social trends that have been going on, and in fact, the best way to understand populism is by thinking about how these kind of two things interact, right? And so here the argument would be something like, look, we've had maybe background economic shifts, and these have made people, particularly, again, white folks, much more concerned about their status, and they turn around and they blame immigrants or minority groups for all of these problems when, in fact, you know, there's other, lots of broader things going on, right? So again, economic, social, demographic trends, this is kind of the way that I think most people have talked about it. And again, just to look at some of the evidence, particularly for this question about social change, there is definitely, again, some evidence. You will see that people who vote for populist parties are more likely to blame, you know, immigrants or minority groups for their country's problems. But I actually want to suggest that this kind of focus, which is, again, I think the dominant focus both in the academy and in the media, is missing something really important if we want to understand populism overall. Right? So what we need to remember, right, is that democracy, right, is supposed to be responsive to its citizens, right? And so while it's definitely important if we want to understand populism and if we want to understand what's going on with liberal democracy to look at these broader social trends and economic trends, we have to understand that ultimately, right, dissatisfaction with democracy comes when people believe that their parties and their politicians and their political institutions more generally are not responding to their needs and demands, right? When they're not listening to what people's concerns are and when they're not helping them solve problems, right? So it's not, in other words, merely the fact of change, economic change or social change, that's so politically significant. It only becomes politically problematic if people believe, again, that their governments, their parties, and their politicians can't deal with that change, that they're unable or unwilling to help, again, mitigate the effects of that change, deal with the consequences of that change, etc. Right? So what I'd like to suggest is that if we want to understand populism, we have to look not just at sort of these broader changes that have been going on in the economy and society, but how or whether, again, political institutions have responded to them. Okay, so there are lots and lots of signs, in fact, that our political institutions, or I'll talk about political institutions in Europe, have actually become much less responsive over the past generation, much less able to bring citizens' concerns up into, again, government. And elites are being much less kind of responsive to what citizens actually think, again, are the challenges facing them, their communities, and their societies more generally. So the first thing to note is that there's been a very significant decay in political parties, the strength of political parties in Europe, right? So here's just a little chart, obviously, talking about party membership, right? So there's been a very significant decline in the number of people who actually belong to political parties, right? The point of parties is to link society with the government, right? And so membership in a party was a way to, again, to send information back and forth, for citizens to get involved in the political process, for elites to transmit down to, again, society what kinds of things they were thinking about, what kinds of policies they were considering, and again, for citizens to transmit up the food chain, so to speak, to politicians and to government what they were concerned about. But we don't have very strong membership parties in Europe the way we would have had a generation ago. Similarly, ties to civil society organizations, most often mentioned here are ties to unions, but actually in Europe you had political parties with strong ties to other civil society organizations, again, as a way to bring citizens into the political process and to transmit information and concerns back and forth. Declining ties to local level activists. Again, parties would often cultivate people at the local level and bring them up through the parties. They would spend their lives there sometimes, for better or worse, very much less the case today. And leadership with many fewer ties to the grassroots overall. So Peter Mayer, who's perhaps the most, or was, he died recently, the most influential student of political parties, wrote a great book precisely on the decay of political parties in Europe some years ago, and he wrote, "The age of party democracy is past. Although the parties themselves remain, they have become so disconnected from the wider society, pursue a form of competition that is so lacking in meaning that they no longer seem capable of sustaining democracy," right? Of tying society to the government in some way that was truly meaningful. The most citizens have turned from being participants into spectators. The most notable decay in the political party family, of course, has been the decline of the center-left. Much more significant than the decline of parties on the center-right, although both traditional, again, big parties on the left and big parties on the right, the center-right parties would be often Christian democratic parties in Europe, both of these parties have declined, right? But the decay on the left is even more so. So you can see this here. And in Europe today, for instance, there's only left-wing parties in power in Spain and Portugal. Now, why should we care particularly about the decline of the center-left if we're interested in populism and dissatisfaction with democracy? Well, historically, the center-left, social democratic parties, labor parties, these were the parties that were supposed to champion the folks who felt disadvantaged by capitalism, at risk, left behind, who felt, again, disadvantaged in some way. And so that was the historic role of these parties. They were supposed to champion these people and bring their concerns into the political system. Center-left parties, social democratic, labor parties, also their role sort of during the decades after the Second World War was precisely to kind of cushion change, right? To help citizens, to protect citizens from, again, economic risk, the destabilizing effects of capitalism and all these kinds of things. So the decline of these parties, I think, again, it's not just particularly notable, but particularly consequential. And one obvious thing that's happened, right, is that you've seen in many recent elections people who would in the past have voted for, again, social democratic or labor parties fleeing to these populist parties. So there's been this kind of direct transfer of voters, right, from the center-left to populist parties. So in the recent German election, the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, the sort of right-wing populist party, did particularly well against among former SPD voters. In fact, ironically perhaps, although I think not ironically, there's clear, I think, reasons for this, the right-wing populist party took proportionately more votes from the far left party than from anything else, right? And I think the reasons for that are probably that what this is really is a protest against the system or against government, right? So if you could move from voting for the far left to the far right, it's clearly not the ideology of these parties that's drawing you in. It's the fact that this is a strong protest, a sense that, again, the existing political parties and the existing government are not responding to your needs, right? And so you're going to vote for the party that seems most likely to kind of press this kind of criticism. Same is true also in the Austrian elections in 2017. A lot of folks who had previously voted for the center-left party, the Social Democratic Party, fleeing to the populist party. I'm missing half of my graph here. The Swedish elections, which just happened, same kind of thing. The far-right populist party is now the second largest party among the traditional supporters of the Social Democratic Party, even among unionized workers, right? So you see a lot of this going on in different parts of Europe. So decay of political parties, particularly parties of the center-left. Other things that are worth mentioning, again, to think about in the European context. So the first is the European Union, right, which has clearly in the minds of many citizens become a way, we have an expert on the European Union here, become a kind of excuse for citizens to see their governments as not responsive, right? To see the EU as making decisions that affect their lives, that bypass the democratic process, right? So the EU is making these decisions and citizens feel like they have no direct say in these decisions, they have no direct impact on these decisions, and so this is obviously a source of immense frustration. We have also combined with this the rise of neoliberalism, which again also seems to many to have taken power out of the hands of national governments and put it in the hands of sort of markets or business or the wealthy, right? So this combination of things has led many people to feel like their national governments are no longer in control, right? That they can't actually or won't actually respond to their needs and concerns, right? So there's these two quotes from very recent, the Italian case in the election, the recent Italian election, right? And so here is the European Budget Commissioner. My concern and expectation is that the coming weeks will show that the development of markets, government bonds, and the economy of Italy will be so far-reaching that this will be a possible signal to voters not to vote for populists on the right or left. Now, why is this a sort of outrageous statement? Because basically what he's saying is, look, you can vote for whoever you want, but actually what your government should be and what your government can do, you're going to be punished for making the quote-unquote wrong choice. Now, that's just not the kind of thing that you want to tell people, because the whole point, again, of democracy is that, you know, you're supposed to be voting for a government that is in turn supposed to be responding to your needs. And basically what's being said here is, yeah, you vote for whoever you want, but in fact those decisions are not in your hands or the hands of your government. Refugee crisis, again. The European Union made a huge mistake in selfishly leaving Italy alone to contend with the refugee crisis, says the director of the social science think tank in Bologna. The EU rules were that countries receiving immigrants had the duty to sort out those who qualify for political asylum from those who do not. This meant the burden of the massive uptick in refugees fell mainly on Italy, Greece, and Spain, all countries contending with major economic problems, right? Again, the idea was that this was being foisted on them by the European Union. They had neither the interest in nor the resources to deal with it, and they did not vote for this kind of thing. And so, you know, what was their national government going to be doing about it? Okay, so the basic point of this is that if people come to believe that their governments and their parties and their politicians are unresponsive, that is to say that they cannot or they will not do anything to deal with, again, these disruptive changes that are facing their society, why would they not lose faith in democracy? Why would they not lose faith in their governments? And in fact, you can see a lot of evidence for these kinds of things, right? So if you're dissatisfied with something, you basically have two options. One is you can opt out. Right? I'm dissatisfied with this whole process. I'm disgusted with it. I don't believe it has anything to do to help me solve my problem. So I'm just going to not participate anymore. And there's an incredible drop in participation rates. By the way, you'd see exactly the same trends in the United States, right? So decline in voting turnout, even in Europe, where historically voting turnout has been high. It's even been more of a drop off in the US, where, again, voting turnout has always been historically low. If you looked, by the way, at other types of political participation that is more requires more effort. So again, joining a party, getting involved in a campaign in some way, joining some civil society organization that's involved in political causes, those rates of participation, by the way, would have dropped off even more than voting. So you see this again across the board in both Europe and in the United States. And definitely, declining faith in democracy is linked to populist voting, right? So you can see this if you ask, again, people, you know, how do they feel about populist parties? What would they do about it? What does democracy require? So for democracy to be healthy, right, it requires not just that people can vote, right, that there be elections. It's not just that those elections have to be free and fair, the votes have to count, right? There can't be rigging of the elections, but the votes need to matter, right? Political decisions must, to some degree, reflect the will of the people. They must be responsive to citizens, okay? Democracy is essentially, again, self-government. The whole point of it is that the people are supposed to rule. And the very fact that growing numbers of people feel that this is not the case, right, is why not just that they vote for populists, but it also helps you understand the kind of rhetoric or political strategies that populists use. So these are two videos from the recent election, obviously, in the United States, 2016, and the last French presidential election. I like to play them for my students, but I obviously can't do them here. What's remarkable about them, and if you watch the, you know, sort of campaign videos of other populists or read their literature, is there's always the same themes returning, right? Okay, so I am your voice, Donald Trump says, the voice of the forgotten people. Today we are transferring power back to you, the people, right? Marine Le Pen, right? The aim of our program is to give the people a voice, right? Her campaign was in the name of the people, right? Now, again, probably most of the people in this room, most of the folks in this room think this is disingenuous and obnoxious. And you may very well, many people in this room, disagree with the things that Trump and Le Pen stand for. But they are tapping into dissatisfaction that is indeed quite real, right? That is indeed reflective of the fact that political institutions have not been very responsive to many people over the past years and maybe the past generation. And they are pulling out of this wellspring of dissatisfaction with democratic institutions the ability to make these kinds of claims, right? That the people have been ignored and that therefore you should vote for someone who promises to essentially kind of blow the whole system up, because what do you have to lose? You haven't been getting a lot of responsiveness from your political elites, your political parties, and your government for quite some time. So let me stop there. And again, the point maybe that I'd like to leave you with is to think about what's going on today in liberal democracy, not just in the terms of these major, again, social and economic changes, technological changes, very, very important, but to remember that it's the job of government to deal with change. It's the job of government to be responsive to its citizens. And so if we really want to understand what's going on, we have to look not just at, again, these broader structural factors, but what our political elites and institutions have been doing about them more generally. So thank you.
Great. All right, so we're going to ask, we're going to have a little conversation first. First of all, Sherry, thanks so much for a great talk. I find quite compelling your argument that people who are less satisfied with their parties are more likely to vote for right populist parties. That makes a lot of sense. But it also seems like countries with pretty varied governmental institutions are moving in the same direction. And so you take, for example, levels of trust in government. And I like to share with my class some measures that were taken in Sweden and the U.S. And in Sweden, over 50% of people supported government, they supported big business, they supported unions. And these data were not gathered that long ago. I mean, maybe like 10 or 15 years ago. And in the United States, everybody was down like around 20%. So 20% for government, 20% for unions, 20% for big business. I mean, they didn't like anybody very much. So I just wonder why that is, that you see this parallel movement. And I also wonder if you could disaggregate a bit the policy changes or political changes that governments have made to bring this situation on themselves. Because it seems like some societies, virtually all industrialized countries at this point, do I really want to say this, are functioning better than the United States in terms of actually getting policies done, getting reform measures done. So I just wonder if you could say a bit more about what are the differences and what brings us to this state across the board.
Well, those are big questions. So let me start with the first one, because I think it's, again, it's really very tied up with thinking about not just why people might vote for populists, but also sort of growing dissatisfaction or with democracy and growing decline in the quality of liberal democracy. So if you look at actually these questions that have been asked about trust in a whole variety of institutions, political institutions, government, political parties, political elites, as well as, you know, sort of social or economic institutions, business and the media, there's definitely big differences between answers in different countries. So like you said, the United States happens to be, folks give particularly low trust in these institutions, much higher in a place like Sweden. But again, what's interesting and worrying is that the trend has been going down pretty much across the board. So admittedly from much higher levels in places like Scandinavia, but still going down, which seems to indicate again that people feel that these institutions are not working as they should. And that, I think, is very troubling, right? Because the quality of democracy has to be related to how much people trust it, how much people have faith in it. Maybe that's the better way to put it. And so the fact that these trends have been again, going down across the board, even in high trust countries, leads us to think that there's not only something worrying going on here, but that this is, again, a sort of cross-national trend. As for the particular policies, I mean, this one of the interesting things is, again, if you look at different countries, particularly on the economic front, even countries that have done relatively well over the past, 10 years. So the obvious cases here would be Germany, Sweden, which I just mentioned, places even like Hungary, right, which is not even a democratic country anymore. Now, there's definitely economic suffering in all of these countries. There's no doubt about that. But overall, these countries have done quite well economically over the past years. Actually, Poland is the better case than Hungary. Mm-hmm. Poland has done very well over the past years in comparison, particularly to its counterparts in Eastern Europe. And yet, again, you've seen the rise of this dissatisfaction. So clearly there's something else going on here. It's either, as I said initially, which is very hard to get at with statistics, perceptions, right? So it's not so much that individuals are doing worse in any great numbers, but their sense of kind of risk of change or of divisions in society has grown, and this makes them uneasy. As far as the social stuff is concerned, here also it's complicated, right? Because there have been places like Sweden where you've seen dramatic social changes and a sense, again, that governments are just not in control of that process. And then you've seen other places where there's actually very low immigration. Again, someplace like Poland would be a good case. But people are hysterical about threats to their national identity. So it's very hard, as I said, to connect either direct broad changes or specific government actions to this. But what you do see over and over again is that when you ask people who have voted for these parties what they're concerned about, it's, again, some general sense of risk. They often tend to be extremely pessimistic, right? Again, even though they themselves have not suffered economically, even though they themselves may never have seen an immigrant, they're very worried about the future of their country's, again, national identity, national culture, and they're very concerned about the way the world is changing, right? So it's this more general sense of kind of, again, pessimism, unease, fear of change, and again, the sense that their governments, their parties, and their politicians are just somehow or another not in control of what's going on. That seems to be, again, what the data indicates is the most pervasive thing that kind of joins these folks in different places.
So this is all really interesting to me. And I guess the place that I would push back then a little bit, because that story seems to me a bit different than its government institutions. I think it's more something to do with social relations of production, to use the old Marxist term, or class relations. So we have this period where we're getting an increased polarization between rich and poor. It's happening with deindustrialization. Deindustrialization is driving it, and then we worsen it with some of our government policies. But it's happening across the advanced industrialized world where people are feeling less secure. And there's a lot of kind of comparative relative disadvantage here. So even if I'm doing okay, as long as I feel like you're doing better, I might feel kind of irritated by that because I feel like I'm not enjoying the benefits of the rise. And it strikes me that there is a politics of discontent associated with this changing class structure that is independent of the actions of governmental institutions. So I just wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, so I mean, let me be clear. It's not that I don't think that there have been important, let's say, economic changes that have changed, you know, sort of class structures and, you know, relationships between workers and business and all those kinds of things. Those things have actually happened. But again, it's the job of government to kind of help deal with those things, right?
Right.
So again, when I said before, I want to clarify, I think it's very hard to identify a particular policy or type of policy choice that can explain, again, populist voting or dissatisfaction. I think what does seem to very much bother people, right, is the sense that governments are not in control of what's going on, right? So if they feel that their societies have become more divided, if they feel that they are more at risk, even though themselves they are not suffering economically, right, if they feel that there are these changes out there, whatever they are, technological, economic, that their governments are not in control of, that seems to make people, a lot of people, again, easily dissatisfied and frustrated, and therefore have a greater tendency to vote for parties that are sort of anti-establishment. So again, I think it's important to think about the distinction between being pissed off at particular policies and being pissed off, again, at the sense that their politicians and parties and governments are not responsive. Now, the whole point of that, you know, like, okay, party membership and other things have declined, is that part of the issue here, I think, clearly is that there are simply less ways that people are tied to their politicians, parties, and governments than they would have been in the past. Mm-hmm. And right. their politicians and parties are also less tied to the grassroots than they would have been in the past. And again, maybe people are even more familiar with this in the United States. So if you look at the Democratic Party, for instance, total atrophy at the grassroots level in many places. And American political parties were never as strong as European parties, right? European parties, especially of the center-left, had very strong ties to civil society organizations, very high memberships, very long-term cultivation of kind of activists. And these kinds of things have really atrophied. And so what this has done is kind of separated, again, parties and therefore governments from the people in a way that didn't exist a generation ago. And I think this is part of not only why governments are less responsive, but why people feel that they lack these kinds of, again, ties to their, you know, to the establishment that they might very well have had a generation ago, and that might have given them an avenue not only for expressing their concerns and getting involved, but for making sure that people, you know, heard the demands of you know, a wider range of groups, let's say.
Okay, so I have one more question, and then I'm going to turn it over. And so how much of this has to do with the behavior of political elites and other kinds of elites? So part of me thinks that we're the part of the problem. We're the velociraptors of the post-industrial age. We're the ones that are kind of gobbling up all the resources and preying on people who are in the one-down position. We're the ones that at the Democratic Convention are standing up and saying, America's already great. We don't have to make it great again. Completely tone deaf to the people in the kind of the losers of globalization and deindustrialization. So how much do elites and this kind of urban, rural, core periphery, cultural differentiation matter to this story?
So, I mean, I'm sure you're asking a question because there's been obviously a lot of writing about this, particularly in the American case, right? The idea that the sort of cultural elite has not only become increasingly distant from people in some parts of the country, but kind of disdainful of them. I mean, I think there may be something to that, but I think that if we even sort of narrow our focus to something more empirical, and in particular in the European context, one of the things that you can just see empirically, right, without having to have a judgment about this, is that the folks who are running political parties today, particularly on the center-left, and this is probably true to some degree of the Democratic Party, are now much more different from their voters than they would have been a generation ago. They're much more highly educated. They have much different views, particularly, to get back to your point, on social and cultural issues than their voters do. They go to different, again, educational institutions. They have different kinds of, you know, whatever, backgrounds. And so there is, in fact, a growing just sort of empirical socioeconomic distinction between the folks who are running parties and their voters much more so than there would have been a generation ago. And in the United States, you can see that also simply because now, even more than a generation ago, to run a campaign means that you have to, partially because of the atrophy of political parties, you have to raise the money more on your own than you would have a generation ago, which means that even if you yourself are not wealthy, you must have those ties. You must be willing to listen to those kinds of people. You must have those kinds of, again, you know, sort of networks and connections. And so the perception that elites are much more different than average folks is not incorrect, even if we want to put aside judgments about, you know, which social or cultural views or, you know, whatever. There is actually a growing divergence between, again, the sort of socioeconomic strata that elites, political elites come from, and, you know, sort of, I don't know, your average voter, whatever that means. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so let's take some questions here. Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, I have a question, sort of two-part. First, you mentioned that there's a lot of decline, especially in Europe and the U.S., in the democratic quality at the beginning, but overall we are seeing trends go up at least. In are there specific examples you would point to of societies that are doing well democratically? Especially ones that could be modeled by some of these societies that are not doing so well. And then the follow-up, if there are good examples you could talk about, how could our societies model those better?
Well, those are great questions and difficult ones. So if you actually look at which countries have their scores, so to speak, have gone up over the past years, they tend to be somewhat smaller countries. There are some Latin American countries that have done better. There are some countries in Africa that are doing better. Again, there have been big declines pushing a lot of these things in the countries that are most populous. So India and China, although China was not a democracy, it's gone even further down in the authoritarian direction. And again, other big countries like Brazil, which have also declined. So the places that have gone forward, so to speak, where their democracies have gone higher in quality, tend to be from a relatively lower position. So it's hard to see how the countries that I was talking about today, Europe and to a much lesser degree the United States, could learn from them. But we know that they're characterized by certain kinds of things, right? So the things that have been going on in Europe and the United States, you know, polarization, these kinds of things, these are generally, you know, again, not good for democracy. So we can figure out perhaps some of the particular characteristics of, again, good and bad, but it's not easy to figure out exactly how to deal with them. I mean, that's something, I mean, we could talk more about, but those are, you know, that's the next step. Once you have identified the problems, again, figuring out what the solutions to them is the next step. Yeah, good question.
I think your analysis is basically excellent, though I think Kathy puts an important spin on it via the questions. I would add to the economic side, because you talk a lot about elites or governments not being in control, not wanting to be in control. That's more what I'd say. But you say they're not reacting to the popular demands. Okay, but you yourself mentioned the word neoliberalism. You mentioned globalization in the beginning. I would put more emphasis on bringing that back in to the end and saying, yes, but look, people are getting a correct sense around the world that their governments are incapable of reacting to their demands, and because corporations, businesses, and neoliberal ideology are much stronger now. That's a long-term trend. And I think people are correctly seeing that they have less control. Your quote about Italy, right, was perfect to illustrate that. You know, and people like Clinton and others and even Obama, you know, say in their various writings, you know, when I met with my Treasury Secretary, he told me the bond market would determine everything. You know, slight exaggeration. So I would bring that back in more and say that that's the other level that you yourself reference, but I think not strongly enough, that you know, most Western industrialized countries are much more out of their own control. Look at the financial crisis. You know, what did the Germans tell the Greeks? You know, you can't, right? They said, you can't do anything. We're in charge. We own your bonds.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think that's 100% right. I mean, and I think that that's a large part of this sense, again, that people have that their democratic elites and their governments are not able or willing to respond to their needs, right? So some of this, I think, is, again, the sort of institutional decline that I talked about, for instance, with political parties. But some of it, again, is this sense that, again, I'm going to vote for Mr. X or Ms. Y, and it's not going to matter because the bond market or the European Union or businesses are going to determine what my government says. This is just deadly. This is just deadly. This is both deadly from a practical perspective and from the perspective of democracy. I mean, why would you have faith in democracy if your politicians are telling you our hands are tied? That's ridiculous, right? And it's also, I think, empirically incorrect, right? So both economically, if you want to think about it, and democratically, governments turning to their citizens and saying, we can't do anything. Our hands are tied, right? Because the bond market is unpunished. Well, you know, that's not what democracy is about. It can't be. So yes, I think that there's a lot of things going on here to give people this sense, again, whatever, the establishment, political parties, political elites, are not able or willing to respond to them. And certainly this story about, you know, neoliberalism, and particularly I think the acceptance of too much of it by the left is a large part of what was going on.
Hi, I just had a question in regards to your discussion around globalization. So if you look at the so-called losers of globalization, as you referred to them, largely people who have not the same level of access to education, their jobs have become obsolete in terms of technology. why isn't there more of just a direct focus on making more winners, so to speak, of globalization? So if you think about the cost of education in the United States and how exorbitant it is really to receive an education in the United States, you're really dealing with a class of people that's becoming more and more limited in terms of just accessing higher education. And in terms of looking at globally skilled workers, it's really people who are going to be able to accumulate more and more high-level skilled jobs who will be the so-called winners of globalization. Yet there's just this paralysis around what you can do with these losers in terms of even discussion from these elites that talk about coming up with solutions where they'll pay people a livable wage just so that they don't create chaos in the streets. So I just don't understand why there isn't more emphasis and why there isn't more focus on coming up with viable solutions, because the problems are only going to be coming worse.
I agree with you. I mean, obviously, if you want people not to get angry at markets, at business, at capitalism, at globalization, then governments have to provide a way to help folks adjust to, again, economic and technical change. That seems pretty straightforward. Why governments have not done a better job of that, I wish I had the answer to that. Certainly one aspect of that would have to be improving the quality of education and the access to education. That would be particularly true in the United States, where it has become increasingly expensive for people. That's less of an issue in Europe, where education still remains largely free, although the quality has declined in some places. But yeah, I mean, if you want people not to get angry at capitalism, let's say, to use, you know, sort of the old-fashioned term, then governments have to provide them with the tools and the resources to adjust to economic change.
Let's put our hands together and give it up for Professor Sherry Brown.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Sherry Berman, professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Professor Berman's lecture was titled Populism and the Future of Liberal Democracy in the West, and was presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Center for the Study of Europe director Kathy Jo Martin. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.